Hi, I'm Neil Denny, and you're about to listen to another Little Atoms Road Trip podcast. I'm at Caltech in Pasadena in California, and I'm just about to talk to Edward Stone. Edward Stone joined Caltech as a research fellow in physics after receiving his Master of Science degree and PhD in physics at the University of Chicago. Over the years, he's held various positions from assistant professor to vice president for astronomical facilities. In 1972, he became project scientist for the Voyager mission, a position he currently still holds. He was the director of JPL from January 1991 to April 2001, when he went back to teaching at Caltech. While he was the director, JPL's Mars Pathfinder and its Sojourner rover sent back images that were seen by millions of people on television and the web. Among other successes were the Mars Global Surveyor, Deep Space One, Cassini, Stardust, and the 2001 Mars Odyssey. Edward Stone, thank you very much for speaking to Little Atoms today.
Good to be here.
You have a long and illustrious association with Caltech, which is where we sat right now. Let's perhaps briefly talk about how you got interested in physics and space science in the first place.
Well, I grew up during the Second World War and afterwards, and at that time, of course, atomic physics was the frontier physics. And I was very interested in understanding things. I just had that interest right from as far back as I can remember. And so I decided to major in physics when I was in high school. And when I went away to the University of Chicago, it was, in fact, to do nuclear physics, which, as I said, was the frontier experimental science with accelerators getting bigger and bigger every year, and Nobel Prizes and all that sort of thing. And I was very lucky in the sense that I had just gone to the university in 56, and in 57, Sputnik was launched. And a whole new field opened up just as I was beginning my graduate career. And so I managed to begin my work in space with the launch of my thesis experiment in 1961 as a graduate student. So the timing was remarkably fortunate.
And that was in cosmic rays you were looking at. Let's perhaps have a brief talk about what that experiment was about.
Yes, I developed an instrument to measure energetic ions coming from the sun. The sun has a large eruptions, solar flares, and occasionally they accelerate some particles up to a fraction of the speed of light, energetic particles, which can penetrate. And so if you're in space, you're above the atmosphere, which absorbs all that, fortunately for us down here. But above there, above space, one can actually detect these things coming from the sun. And in those days, there had been essentially nothing done above the atmosphere. Space was all new. And so I built an instrument which was launched on the Discoverer 36, which was in a polar orbit. It was launched from here in California into a polar orbit, and it was battery-powered, so it lasted all of 5 days. But that and another instrument launched on a previous mission, similar mission, were the basis for my thesis, that is, measuring these particles coming from the sun, seeing how they came into the Earth's magnetic field in the polar regions, and some of the, you know, it was really all new. Everything was new in those days.
Later on, you were the principal investigator on some of the most iconic NASA missions. And I'd like to look back at some of those, if we may. And probably the most iconic one is the Voyager missions. You were project scientist on Voyager, and interestingly, you still are.
That's right.
So let's talk about why you still are.
Well, it turns out that I came to Caltech in 1964 as a postdoctoral researcher, and then I got on the teaching faculty. And in 1972, JPL was developing this mission, which eventually became Voyager. And they were just starting that in 1972, and they came to they were looking for basically the chief scientist for the mission. The mission has on it has 11 scientific teams, and the project scientist organizes and sort of chairs the science activities on the mission. And since I had already done a number of experiments in space, even though I was rather young at the time, I was asked if I would become the project scientist. And so I said, yes, that was 40 years ago this year, and I've been the project scientist on this mission ever since.
What does a project scientist on the Voyager missions do now, today?
Today, we have just five teams of scientists because we've flown by all the planets and we're now headed toward interstellar space. So we still have maybe 20, 25 scientists involved in looking at the Voyager data directly. And my job is to provide the overall direction for the scientific program and to work with all of the team members to optimize what we can do with this mission of discovery.
Let's look a little at the background to the Voyager missions. Where did the impetus to go to those outer planets come from, I guess, in the first place?
It's very interesting. There's a graduate student at Caltech, Gary Flandreau, who in 1965 was asked to look for opportunities to fly by a planet in such a way that it would give a boost to the spacecraft, a gravitational assist, like a slingshot. And he discovered in the process of looking at all these different possibilities that in 1977 it would be possible to launch a spacecraft in such a way it would fly by Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. They were all lined up together on the same side of the sun in exactly the right formation to fly by all four. It was called the Grand Tour. So JPL, this was 1965, JPL began designing a mission which would do this Grand Tour. And that was called the Grand Tour mission. It was a much bigger project than Voyager. It was so big at that time in the early, about 1971, beginning of 1972, NASA was trying to do the shuttle, trying to do what became the Hubble Space Telescope, doing what was became Viking, the landers on Mars, and they said, can't do it all, cost too much, so we're going to cancel the Grand Tour. Once in every 176 years, this alignment happened. So there was a lot of interest. Can't we find something that we can send on this opportunity? Because it's once in 176 years that they're lined up. And so JPL, I was involved at that point in developing an instrument, but I was not the chief scientist yet when that happened. And so JPL quickly looked at a lower cost, simpler spacecraft, which they call Mariner Jupiter Saturn 77. It was a Mariner spacecraft which had flown kind of like but had flown by Mercury and Mars and Venus, but designed just to Jupiter and Saturn, a four-year mission to Jupiter and Saturn rather than a 12-year mission to Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. That, of course, reduced the complexity, reduced the cost, and if we were clever, we could preserve the opportunity that if we succeeded at Saturn, we could go on to Uranus and Neptune. And so that was early 1972. A project was then approved at that with those goals in and started officially July 1st of 1972. And shortly thereafter, I joined as the chief scientist.
There were two Voyager craft launched. What was the reasoning behind launching the two?
In that era, the probability of both surviving was not at all sure. Even launches sometimes did not work. So and those were the days where you basically built two, just to be sure that at least one would succeed. And it turned out that was really important to us because we had our mission objective was to Saturn. Saturn and its moon Titan and its rings. That meant that Voyager 1, which was the first to reach its Saturn, would fly behind Saturn in such a way that it would go behind the rings. And the rings were inclined in the plane of the sky. And so when Voyager flew by, it had to head up out of the plane of the planets. No further planetary encounters. Voyager 2 would have done exactly the same thing if Voyager 1 had not succeeded. And we would not have had Uranus and Neptune. Fortunately, Voyager 1 worked in November of 1980, and NASA approved us staying in the plane of the planets at Saturn so we could head on to Uranus and Neptune.
We'd already launched, as you mentioned, Mariner probes to the sort of inner planets of the solar system. This was the first time we'd attempted something to the outer planet. So were there unique challenges in terms of the conditions in space?
The challenges were, first of all, getting to Jupiter. That is, could you get through the asteroid belt? And the Pioneer 10 and 11 spacecraft were designed to tell us whether that was a hazard or not. And they were launched in 1972 and 1973. So just as we were beginning Voyager design, those two spacecraft were on their way. There was no evidence of any problem with the asteroid belt. It's empty, except for a few big things. And the other key question was, two other key questions, what is the radiation environment like at Jupiter? We knew it had a radiation belt because there were radio emissions coming from Jupiter. And it turned out it was much more intense than we even imagined. And we actually had to redesign the spacecraft after Pioneer 10 flew by in December of 1973. We took 9 months off and changed the spacecraft electronic design so that, in fact, it could survive the radiation environment. So that was another key thing. And the third key thing was the rings at Saturn. And Pioneer 11 flew by Jupiter in such a way that it could arrive at Saturn and fly by Saturn at exactly the same location that Voyager 2 needed to fly by to go on to Uranus. And it very successfully flew through there, and we knew that that hazard was, again, acceptable. So the pioneers really were very important to establishing how hazardous space is.
For a long time, you were a spokesperson relaying information about these missions to the public. So tell us about what was the public reaction like to the Voyager missions when the images started to come through.
It was really quite remarkable how strong the interest was. We would have daily press conferences during the encounters, lasting about 10 days, starting perhaps 8 days before the closest approach and extending a couple of days past the closest approach. We would have a room full of reporters from around the world reporting. The only place you could see the images was if you were at JPL. There was no internet at that time. You couldn't go on your computer and see all this. You had to get, if you're public, the only way you could get the data was if it showed up in the press or on television. Mm-hmm. For that to happen, the reporters had to be at JPL to get it. And so it was a rather different era than the current era. As time went on, that was 1979. By 1989, which was our Neptune encounter, then technology was such that we could actually beam the images back to planetariums off of satellites. Mm-hmm. It still wasn't possible to do it at home. Well, some people with large antennas who knew how to do it could do it, but by and large, it was only at the planetariums. Mm-hmm. And there would be people staying up all night to see the encounter with Triton, the moon Triton, at Neptune. The public really was engaged with this whole sense of exploring and seeing things which nobody had seen before, in fact, which we didn't even imagine we would find, like volcanoes on Io. It was just one discovery after the other, and it really did capture the public interest. And even today, as we're leaving the solar system, I have interviews from around the world about where is Voyager at, when is it going to leave the solar bubble. It's part of the journey that we all have shared of exploring our solar system and now beyond.
Let's perhaps look a little bit closer at some of the remarkable things that it found on some of the moons of the large planets. You just mentioned the immense volcanic activity on Io, for instance. What else did we find?
Well, the volcanic activity on Io, there's 10 times more than here on Earth. Before Voyager got to Jupiter, the only known active volcanoes in the solar system were here on Earth. Mm-hmm. And so it was really amazing to find 10 times more volcanic activity on this little moon than on the entire Earth. So that was just an example of how we found things that we really hadn't thought we would even thought about. The other moon, another moon which is right next to Io, is Europa, mm-hmm. which has we knew it had a white ice surface from ground-based data, but when we got there, it was perfectly smooth. There were no mountains, there were no valleys, just cracks, just like an ice pack on a liquid water ocean. And that's, in fact, exactly what's there, and that's what the Galileo mission, which subsequently went into orbit around Jupiter, really showed that, yes, there is almost surely a liquid water ocean beneath its icy crust. And so, again, before Voyager, the only liquid we knew about in the solar system were the oceans on Earth. Everything else was dry. We go to a moon of Jupiter, there's probably, well, almost certainly, water beneath its icy crust. So each planet had these kinds of surprises. Titan, which has a deep nitrogen atmosphere, mm-hmm. like the Earth's, but much colder than Earth, only 95 above absolute zero. And it has clouds, but they're not clouds of water. There's no water in the atmosphere to speak of. There's methane. Methane's natural gas. The section of sunlight, which here on Earth creates oxides, which are the smog we all have to live with. On Titan, what's the smog do? It creates molecules, hydrocarbon molecules, molecules which are the fundamental building blocks of life, actually, mm-hmm. are created in the atmosphere of Titan and are raining down on the surface. And so we believed, in fact, that Titan would have a water cycle, but it's not a water cycle, it's a methane cycle, where methane would form lakes, it would evaporate, form clouds, it would rain down on the surface, form lakes, just as water does here on Earth. The Cassini mission, which had the Huygens probe from Europe, basically landed on that surface and certainly saw evidence of stream beds and so on. And then the orbiting Cassini spacecraft with its radar was able to map the surface and find lakes of probably liquid methane on the surface of Titan. So here we had a liquid actually on the surface of another body. And before Voyager, it was only Earth that had liquid of any sort on its surface. So each step of the way. And then you go to Uranus. Both Uranus and Neptune are somewhat smaller than Jupiter and Saturn, but still giant planets compared to the Earth. Uranus is tipped on its side. And so when we flew by it, it was sort of like a bullseye in the sky because it was tipped on its side and the pole was facing the spacecraft. We flew by one of the moons called Miranda. It's a small moon 500 kilometers across, mostly water ice. It's the most complex geologic surface we'd seen. This little world had a dynamic evolution of its surface, which undoubtedly was many billions of years ago, but it was frozen there You could see earthquake faults, scarps, cliffs, all on this little tiny world. Again, very big surprise. Another major surprise was here on Earth, we all know our magnetic pole is up near our rotational pole. That's very convenient for a compass because pointing to the magnetic north is almost pointing to geographic north. And that's true on Jupiter. That's true on Saturn. So what did we find at Uranus? The magnetic pole was nearer the equator than the rotation axis. All of our models all assumed that it would be near the pole because it's the magnetic field is created by the flow of ionized material in the planet as the planet rotates. So you might expect the geometry would be determined by that. It's not. There's clearly a more complex flow pattern in these giant planets than there is even in Earth. So again, our terracentric perspective is what I call it. It's so limiting compared to what nature has really done just in our own solar system, much less all the other planetary systems we now know are out there.
So with Uranus, is the difference in the poles and the magnetic field related to the fact that, as you mentioned, it's tipped completely over on its side?
Oh, it's not because it's tipped. Because we flew onto Neptune, same story, and it's not tipped on its side, all right? So it's more complicated than just being tipped over. It has to do with the fluid flows inside, which somehow are not uniform completely around the planet. They must be localized such that the field has this funny tilt. Another interesting thing, Neptune, which is 30 times as far from the sun as the Earth, so the sunlight is 1/900th. Mm-hmm. It has the least solar energy of any atmosphere in the solar system to drive it. Has the fastest winds. Least energy, fastest winds. Again, another counterintuitive result. Much faster than Jupiter and Saturn. And even the last object we visited, which is its moon, Triton. Mm-hmm. Triton is a captured moon. It orbits Neptune backwards. I mean, all of regular moons orbit the same direction as the planet rotates. This one is backwards, so that's the reason we believe it was captured. It's about the same size as Pluto, so it probably was originally a plan of Pluto. But once it's captured into a very eccentric orbit, and slowly but surely, tidal effects, which cause the volcanoes on Io, melt the water on Europa, circularize the orbit of this moon. And of course, that means all that energy ended up melting Triton. Mm-hmm. And so its surface, again, unlike anything we've ever seen before. On top of that, it's only about 40 degrees above absolute zero. And so the ice in its polar cap, its icy body is mainly water ice. The ice in its polar cap is nitrogen ice. It is so cold, the nitrogen forms ice. And one last surprise was even at 40 degrees above absolute zero, there are geysers erupting from that polar cap at 40 degrees above absolute zero. Mm-hmm. So it's just a remarkable journey where every time we always try to anticipate, well, what are the surprises going to be? And there was always some other surprise we had not anticipated. And, of course, now we're on the interstellar journey, and we're not out of the bubble yet, and we continue to be surprised.
What sort of things do we expect to see right at that very, 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 very edge of our solar system?
Well, the sun creates a bubble around itself. There's a wind blowing radially outward from the sun at 400 kilometers per second, over a million kilometers per hour. It's supersonic. That means the wind is faster than the waves in the wind, so it creates a bubble. The size of the bubble is determined by the pressure inside pushing out from the sun and the pressure outside from the other stuff from other stars. So as the wind approaches the contact with interstellar wind, it has to slow down. It slows down in a supersonic shock, just as in front of a supersonic aircraft. The wind's supersonic. We cross the shock and are now in the subsonic wind, where the wind, which had been radial before that, is starting to turn and flow down the tail of the heliosphere. Outside of this bubble, and we're still inside on both spacecraft, today Voyager 1 is 120 times as far from the sun as the Earth. Neptune's at 30. Mm-hmm. So we're 4 times further out than Neptune, and we're still inside the bubble. Mm-hmm. But we're very close to leaving. We are now on Voyager 1 in a region that have been for the last 2 years, in a region where the wind has come to a stop. It's not blowing out. It's not. It's just kind of, we're calling it a stagnation region, which tells us we're getting very close to the boundary, what's called the heliopause, the boundary between these two winds. How close? Nobody knows. No spacecraft has ever been there before. We could cross the heliopause anytime. Mm-hmm. I think it's likely that in the next 2 or 3 years we will almost certainly cross it, but we don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've tried to tell you, every time we thought we knew something, we found out we didn't really know it. But once we leave the bubble, inside the bubble, we're in the wind that came from the sun. The material came from the sun, most of it. The magnetic field was carried out there from the sun. and we're shielded from the stuff, the cosmic rays, some of the lower energy of which are outside. We cross the boundary, and it's a magnetic boundary, so that means the energetic particles outside can't get in, and the ones inside can't get out. So we'll see a sudden change in the radiation environment. How will it change? We don't know. We think maybe the particles inside won't get out, so those should we shouldn't see anymore, but there could well be a lot of particles outside that can't get in, and those would be the cosmic ray particles. The magnetic field inside is basically spiral. It's horizontal, kinds of east-west, if you like. Outside, the magnetic field we now believe is almost perpendicular to that, and the wind outside is much slower than it is in, well, not slower than the stagnation region, but slower than the general flow of wind inside. So we should, we'll be in the, surrounded by material that was produced by a series of supernova, supernovae, 5 to 15, 20 million years ago. And the shells of all these explosions have merged into clouds. And we are now in one of these clouds, which was ejected by these series 10 million years ago. So the magnetic field will be different than, it won't be the solar. The material out there will not be solar. It will be from other objects that have exploded. And the galactic cosmic rays at the lower energies, which came from those explosions, will be an intensity that we don't know until we get there. We don't know. They can't get in.
You mentioned the Cassini and Huygens mission to Saturn, and other missions that you've been involved in are the Mars Global Surveyor, the Orbiter, and the Pathfinder, the lander,
that
was actually on the surface of Mars. I want to talk a little bit about the Mars missions, but first of all, covering all three of those, you mentioned before about the media climate in which the Voyager missions were in a completely different world now in terms of media. As you said, people have the internet. So was there, you know, significantly a different impact in the reception of those missions?
Mars Pathfinder was the first mission that really entered in the internet era. Mars Pathfinder was a demonstration of the first rover on another planet. It's a little tiny rover, but it really, the fact that there was something that we had built and was sent to the planet and was actually moving around on the planet, again, engaged the public. And part of the reason it was possible, because we actually had mirror sites set up around the world so the public could see exactly what was coming down from the spacecraft at all times. So they could participate in this first journey, robotic journey, on the surface of Mars. And the team, the imaging team, was very good about naming things so that, in fact, you could talk about this rock and that rock. And the little Sojourner rover just circled around its landing base. It did not have much range, didn't have much capability, but it did demonstrate how important mobility was to really exploring a world like Mars.
I remember watching that myself on the internet, watching the pictures coming in, and it was still in the early days of the internet, so often you couldn't get onto the website because there was so much interest in looking at it. But it did really feel like we were watching something revolutionary going on. We could actually see this thing going on. I guess now there's been subsequent rover missions out to Mars. Let's perhaps talk a little bit about the sort of work that we can do with that longer presence on a place. So this is a different thing again. It's in comparison to an orbital mission that's tracking the Global Surveyor, you know, gave us the most advanced mapping of Mars than we ever have. But again, there's a difference to actually being there on the surface, isn't there?
There really is a difference. And I think part of the difference is one that when you see an image from the rover on the surface, it is exactly what you would see if you were standing on the surface. The height is about the same. The cameras are about the same distance from the surface. What is seen is what you would see with your own eyes if you were there. So that you don't get from an orbiter. An orbiter is like nighttime television with weather on it. I mean, you see the Earth. Oh, yeah, I can see the planet, the continents and all that. But it's not like Google where you get there and here you're on a city street. You can look around and see exactly what's on this corner. That's the difference. And it's the fact that it can be done over the web is an important. I think another key thing that I realized with the Mars Pathfinder that was different is that up until that time, the story that you got, somebody else had to develop for you because you didn't have access. That meant that somebody else was deciding what it was important, and you had to tune in at a certain time to get it. Now, you can decide what you want to pay attention to. You can log on anytime you want. Nobody else is between you and the data. And so it's a whole different kind of experience of engagement. Of course, what's missing in that is what I call the guides, the experts who help you understand what it is you should be looking at when you look at the pictures. So that's part, I think, of some of the challenge we have with this new media is how do we keep the very important attribute of the guides, which is what the reporters were. They provided some guidance as to why this was interesting or why where you should look. Hopefully we helped them as a science team do that, but they were the ones interfacing with the public. Now everybody's on their own.
What about future challenges then? There's just been an announcement that there's going to be another mission to Jupiter, a European Space Agency mission. Other places that you would like us to go back or places that you would like us to visit that we haven't been to yet? What would you like to see happen next?
I think the mission to look closely at Europa is very important because it's because of the possibility of liquid water or ocean. There's certainly every reason to believe that the cracking, which is there on its surface, is still happening today. I mean, because the tidal effects on the surface are still there. So that there should be places where fresh cracks are developing. Mm-hmm. And so it's possible that there are places on the surface where whatever is in the ocean comes up where we can get to it easily. So I think Europa is really very important, and finding a way to terribly difficult, hazardous environment and finding a way to actually spend enough time there to do the exploration is one of the big challenges that everyone has. I think Titan is clearly a place that one needs to get back to. The chemistry that's occurring in that atmosphere today may resemble that which occurred here on Earth before life evolved. The oxygen in our atmosphere, of course, came from life. And originally, there was no oxygen. It's like Titan is today. There is no oxygen. And so the chemistry in the early Earth's atmosphere may resemble what we can actually study in Titan today. In addition to that, we really need to get there with more sophisticated instruments because, again, we could be well surprised about what the chemistry is. We have models, but we really need to get down to where the lakes are and the surface and explore. So I think Titan is a long-term objective for exploration. Another moon at Saturn that's very interesting is Enceladus, which has geysers erupting from its south polar region. And so, again, if there's liquid water, question is it possible life in some form? Microbial life, of course, is all we're talking about. Is that possible? Microbial life emerged there or not? It's going to be a challenge because this is a little tiny moon in the Saturn system. So those are the three places. Mars, four. Mars, and Europa, Enceladus, and Titan that deserve really further exploration. And the challenge is, what do you do next? And what are the steps you need to take? Because you can't imagine landing one place on the Earth and exploring within a few miles of that place and believing you understood Earth as a planet. We all know that you wouldn't, right? So that's the situation we're in with Mars. Yes, we have global images, but in fact, in terms of surface exploration, we have just a few places that we've really visited. Some of them very interesting. I mean, I think the little blueberries that the Mars landers found are really remarkable indication there was water on the surface at one time. So those are the challenges.
Just one last question then, and I did want to spend more time looking at this last question, but it's been such an honour to sit here and reminisce with you, so I couldn't really miss that opportunity. But let's talk briefly about some of the research. I mean, where are your research areas now? What's going on here at Caltech? What are you interested in now?
Well, I'm continuing work on Voyager, of course. And also we have two other missions that we're involved with. One is called the Advanced Composition Explorer, which is at the Lagrangian point, which is a point out in front of the Earth, where in fact it stays as the Earth orbits the Sun. That point orbits with it, so it's always sort of upstream, and so we can see in real time the radiation which is coming to the Earth. In fact, it's on the web. You can see the data from our instruments on the web. That's called the Advanced Composition Explorer. It's been up since 1997. And then there are two other spacecraft called STEREO, which were launched by Earth. They're in Earth orbit, but one is leading the Earth in its orbit around the Sun. The other is trailing, and they're moving away from Earth. And today, they're basically equally spaced around. There's 120 degrees to STEREO ahead, 120 degrees to STEREO behind, and 120 degrees between them. So we now have spacecraft on all sides of the Sun. So as the Sun becomes more active, it's a very important time. First time we have this global perspective. Another new mission that we're working on is called Solar Probe Plus. It'll be launched in 2018, and it will actually use Venus to stepwise move in, step by step, in closer and closer and closer to the Sun, and maybe to within 10 solar radii of the Sun. Mm-hmm. The Earth's at 200 and some solar radii. So we will be much closer than anything has ever been, and this is where we believe the energetic particles associated with the solar storms originate. It's where the fast wind originates, and almost surely will be full of surprises. And our simple models, which we've been living with now for 40 or 50 years, will see that we probably don't have all the physics in those models that nature has.
Ed, it's been an absolute pleasure talking with you. Thanks for taking the time to speak with me today.
I'm glad to talk with you.
I'm Annie Drian. That was a Little Atoms Road Trip podcast. The show is produced and presented by Neil Denny and was made possible by a traveling fellowship from the Winston Churchill Memorial Trust. Follow the trip on Twitter @LittleAtoms, and thanks for listening.